This week, we explore the first part of Whither Are We Traveling? A multi-part exposé by Brother Darren A. Lehners. In this exploration, Darren dives into Dwight L. Smith's seminal work, Whither Are We Traveling? And asks some very pertinent questions. While this particular paper was the subject of laudable pursuit many years ago, what can we say about it today? Brother Darren has some ideas. Then, we'll hear from Worshipful Brother Patrick Day in this first installment of Masonic Mythbusters. Did the Christians steal Christmas from the pagans? We'll get a little reflective as we remember the life of Right Worshipful Brother Thomas W. Jackson. And finally, we'll wrap it up by drawing a tarot card and reflecting on its practical meaning in our everyday lives. Are we being too overbearing? Or not enough? All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 527. Happy New Year. Well, I hope you guys all had a great New Year, a great holiday season. It's good to be back with you. I'm renewed, I'm reinvigorated. I have not been on the podcast, of course, for the last couple weeks, but I have been busy. I've been traveling around doing presentations and connecting with my brothers in real life and, you know, really trying to just not catch the Omicron variant. I hope you guys are all equally as healthy and have been staying safe. And if you have contracted the virus, I sympathize, and I hope you get well very soon. In the news, I just wanted to cover a couple of cool dates that'll be coming up I think are worth mentioning here. Some conferences that are happening this year are really going to start creeping up, and I think a lot of us are worrying about whether or not we want to be traveling here or there. So it's beneficial to know what's going on in our own backyards. So of course, Texas Masonicon number 3 is still, as far as I know, is slated for August 20th, 2022. If you go to MasonicConferences.com, you can click on that one and they'll take you to a little video that they made to announce it. Now, I suspect it is still happening. I know the original Masonicon has moved from Massachusetts to New Hampshire this year, and it's scheduled for June 4th, 2022. And that'll be in, again, Manchester, New Hampshire. Masonicon Kansas. This is a brand new Masonicon that's happening. I'm really excited about it. I'll be speaking there as well. It's going to be in the KC Metro, or Prairie Village, Kansas, in 2022, specifically August 27th. And then there's Esotericon 2022. Now, this one is not strictly Masonic. It's very esoteric, philosophical. That will be happening on June 10th through the 12th, and there'll be some kickoff events on the 10th and what is sure to be another great conference. The Masonic Restoration Foundation is having their 11th annual meeting. It's been a couple of years, and they're ready to get back to work. They're going to be having their get-together April 1st through the 3rd in 2022 at the Detroit Masonic Temple. So you can check out their website. The Masonic Restoration Foundation's website, I think it's just MasonicRestorationFoundation.com. One thing that I am very excited about, the Midwest Conference on Masonic Education will be held April 29th in Kansas City, Missouri. So just a few hours away from me here in the Midwest. I hope it's just a few hours for you also, but there's going to be some excellent speakers, including Brother Chuck Dunning and some others that I think we all know and love. And then Masonic Week, February 9th through the 13th, which is probably the next one, is right around the corner. I'm really hoping that that goes off without a hitch also. You can go to amdusa.org and you can scroll down just a little bit, click on the website for Masonic Week, and you can see the registration, which I think is $35. And then you can purchase all the dinner tickets there if you want to or not. I don't purchase them there. I'm hoping I can just pick those up when I get there if I need to. So that's that. I think there are a ton of opportunities for Masonic education and fellowship coming up And I would urge you all to attend something. I hope you guys get to go. You can find all this out, if that was a blur to you, go to MasonicConferences.com, and we've got them all listed there for you. I'll be doing some presentations here in the next few weeks. Notably, for the Kansas Lodge of Research, I'm going to be presenting virtually a newer presentation that was developed to engage and energize Freemasons in today's world. You know, where did we come from, really? What is the purpose of our existence, and what is the divine revelation of our ritual? In this keynote address, I'm really going to try to explore these things, and by the end, we'll be ready to work with our lodge and hopefully change the world. That's going to be a Kansas Lodge of Research members only. So if you're not a member of the Kansas Lodge of Research, you're going to have to wait till the next time I do it in a different lodge. Then I'll be doing, on the 17th, I'll be doing the Legend of Adam's Grave. That will be a virtual presentation also for a lodge in South Carolina. That'll go on at 9 p.m. Central Time. And then on the 22nd, I'm really excited about this one. It's the Illinois Lodge of Research, Prestige Awaits. In this presentation, I'm really just going to focus on the value of the lodges of research around the country, and in particular, the Illinois Lodge of Research. I will be giving some history about it, but really, I want people to think about why everyone should become a member, because it just might be the most important thing you ever join as a Freemason. So I hope to see you maybe on one of those three virtual presentations. I want to thank everybody out there who supports this show, whether you are a patron or a PayPal subscriber. You might be a fellow, a contributor, a producer, or a legacy partner, whichever you are. I want to thank you so much for all of your help, especially going into this new year. We've got some great ideas of some great things to bring to this show. We've got new segments lined up this year that are just going to blow your mind. In fact, we're going to premiere one of them this week. And you heard a little bit about that already in the show opener. And I'm really excited to bring truth to the masses. If you are out there and you're thinking, how can you help support the WCY podcast? Just go to our website, wcypodcast.com, click on the shop, and you can see a number of things that you can purchase there, and all that money goes right back into the show. So we've got our producer's pin, we've got Ancient and Modern Initiation by Max Heindel, completely redone by yours truly. We also have The Master's Word, which is annotated by myself and Brother John Ruark, and How to Charter a Lodge, which has a number of great brothers and sisters in there who have done some amazing work around the country in chartering lodges, and they've got great insights to share there. And, of course, the time-tested and brother-approved It's Business Time, which you can get from us also. So if none of that strikes your fancy, feel free to share our links to the show with your friends and brothers. All right, first up this week is something that I'm very passionate about. Now, Brother Darren Lehners has been starting to write a series of articles, and I think we want to read all of them in succession. So we're going to start with part one this week, and it's called Whither Are We Traveling? And this particular set of articles really deals with Dwight L. Smith's work called Whither Are We Traveling? And it was written in 1963 by, again, Dwight L. Smith, who at that time was a past Grand Master and the current Grand Secretary of the Most Worshipful Grand Lodge of Indiana, Free and Accepted Masons. The book itself has made some amazing predictions, and really nobody listened to it. And what had happened years later was that the Knights of the North, made famous by illustrious brother Christopher Hodapp, put together a book that was called Laudable Pursuit. And Laudable Pursuit was a small book which was a response to Dwight L. Smith's original paper here, Whither Are We Traveling? If you're interested in that book, Laudable Pursuit, you can, of course, get it, I think, on Amazon and on Lulu Press. And if you'd like the audio version, WCY Media, myself, and a few of the brothers of Space Novum Lodge 1183 compiled the audio book that you can get on Audible, and it's really reasonable. I think it's only like $7 or something like that, and all the proceeds for that go back to the Indiana Museum and Library. So without any further delay, let's jump into what Worshipful Brother Darren A. Lehner says in part one of Whither Are We Traveling? On November 28, 2021, I celebrated my 10-year anniversary of being raised to the sublime degree of Master Mason. Thinking I was being clever, I posted on social media a post with the above picture and the caption, "Celebrating my 10-year anniversary today. Those who know, know." Now, a break in the paper is just a interesting piece of artwork which shows a portion of the degree work. Back to the article. I received the congratulatory ego stroke that I was most likely looking for when I posted it. However, out of this came an excellent question. Fellow Midnight Freemason contributor Randy Sanders wrote, "Awesome. What part have you changed in the decade?" My response was, "Randy Sanders, that is an excellent question. I will just say that I personally believe I used the common gavel to smooth some of the rough edges of my ashlar. However, the work in the quarry never ends until I lay down my working tools." End quote. Randy's question made me realize that as much as the past 10 years have shaped me, I still have so much more work to do. As it is said that those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat it, I take the lesson that I've learned, oftentimes the hard way, and use those to help with my decisions in the present, which will impact my future. The future is the only thing we have control over. We exert that control by the decisions we make here and now. The title of my article is an homage to one of the most powerful but probably unknown Masonic writings of the 20th century, Whither Are We Traveling? It was written in 1936 by Dwight L. Smith, who was the past Grand Master and then current Grand Secretary of the Most Worshipful Grand Lodge of Indiana, Free and Accepted Masons. It is his self-examination of Northern American Freemasonry. It is just as valid now in 2021 as it was in 1963. Also, it is saddening as it is almost 60 years old now, and many of the problems he addressed have not been solved in that time. Most Worshipful Brother Smith begins his work with, quote, "The Wailing Wall is crowded these days. Masonic leaders, great and small, are lined up, each awaiting his turn to lift his voice in lamentation. The figures show a falling off of membership. Attendance at lodge meetings is not what it used to be. The thing to do is to adopt this project or that gimmick, and then all will be well. As might be expected, the projects and gimmicks are about as impossible as they are ridiculous." End quote. Sounds familiar, right? Remember, this was written in 1963. He continues with what he calls a faulty diagnosis of Freemasonry. Quote, "At the outset, I may as well precipitate an argument by disposing of the old favorites. 1. Whatever attendance troubles our lodge may be having are not caused by television, nor the automobile, nor by bowling, nor togetherness, nor any of the other busyness in which our restless society is engaged. A multitude of activities may contribute to a decline in lodge attendance, but they do not constitute the cause. When we complain of lack of attendance, what we really are saying is that interest is at a low ebb, for in any organization there is interest, there will be attendance. No amount of television or bowling or endless busyness can usurp the position of eminence a lodge of Freemason occupies in a man's loyalty, if the lodge is in a position to command his loyalty. The ailment isn't quite that simple. We are looking at the symptoms, not the disease. The real source of the trouble is within ourselves. 2. Such problems as we may have will not be solved by forcing men to memorize a set of questions and answers, nor by cramming books and lectures down their throats, nor by any Big Brother plan, nor by devoting our energies and resources to other organizations or movements, however worthy they may be. The cure isn't that simple either. The patient's indisposition will not be relieved by nostrums. The treatment, too, must come from within." End quote. Dwight offers three basic premises for the current woes we face in Freemasonry. Quote, "First, the history of Freemasonry is one of ups and downs. If this brief period is one of the downs, it is nothing compared to some of the crises through which our fraternity has passed. Second, in our membership decline, we again see history repeating itself. It simply is a case of our sins catching up with us. We had a decade in which there was a membership influx that was both unhealthy and unhappy. We ran a production line. We counted new members by the hundreds of thousands. But we couldn't count new Masons, only by the score. Now comes the payoff. Third, whatever is wrong with lodge attendance in 1962 was wrong 25 years ago when I was master of my lodge. I doubt seriously whether lodge attendance has ever been, quote-unquote, what it used to be. I had to work my head off to sustain interest in 1937, end quote. Once again, the above sounds familiar, doesn't it? He comes to this conclusion, quote, "We have only to look at ourselves to discover the cause for whatever unhappy days have come upon us. Our troubles are of our own making. Such corrective measures as we take must go beyond the surface. They must go to the roots of the problem or be of no avail." End quote. After the above conclusion, he begins his self-examination of the conditions that are causing the problem as he sees it. He gives 10 points, which I have quoted below. 1. Let's face it. Can we expect Freemasonry to retain its past glory and prestige unless the level of leadership is raised above its present position? On many an occasion in the past 14 years, masters and secretaries have come into my office to ask my advice on what to do about lagging interest. Again and again, I have said, there is nothing wrong with your lodge, nor with Freemasonry, that good leadership will not cure. I believe that. 2. How well are we guarding the West Gate? Again, let's face it, we are permitting too many to pass who can pay the fee and little else. On every hand, I hear the same whispered complaint. We used to be getting petitions for the degrees from the good, substantial leaders in the community. Now we are getting just what is it they are getting? You know as well as I. 3. Has Freemasonry become too easy to obtain? Fees for the degrees are ridiculously low. Annual dues are far too low. Everything is geared to speed. Getting through as fast as possible and on to something else. The lodge demands little and gets little. It expects loyalty but does almost nothing to put a claim on the man's loyalty. When we ourselves place a cheap value on Masonic membership, how can we expect petitioners and new members to prize it? 4. Are we not worshiping at the altar of bigness? Look it in the face. Instead of devoting our thoughts and energies to ways whereby a new Master Mason may find a sphere of activity within his lodge, we let him get lost in the shuffle. Then we nag and harangue at him because he does not come to meetings to wander around with nothing to do. We are hard at work to make each lodge so large that it becomes an impersonal aggregation of strangers, a closed corporation. What can we expect when we have permitted Freemasonry to become subdivided into a score of organizations? Look at it. Each organization dependent upon the parent body for its existence, yet each jockeying for a position of supremacy, and each claiming to be the pinnacle to which any Master Mason may aspire. We have spread ourselves thin, and ancient craft Masonry is the loser. Downgraded, the symbolic lodge is used only as a springboard. A short-sighted craft we have been to create in our fraternity, a condition wherein the tail can and may wag the dog. 6. Has the American passion for bigness and efficiency dulled the spirit of Masonic charity? The box of fraternal assistance, which once occupied the central position in every lodge room, has been replaced by an annual per capita tax. That benevolence, which for ages was one of the sweetest byproducts of the teachings of our gentle craft, has, I fear, ceased to be a gift from the heart and has become the writing of a check. And, unless the personal element is there, charity becomes as sounding brass and tinkling cymbal. 7. Do we pay enough attention to the festive board? Should any reader have to ask what the festive board is? That in itself will serve to show how far we have strayed from the traditional path of Freemasonry. Certainly the festive board is not the wolfing of a ham sandwich, pie, and coffee at the conclusion of a degree. It is the hour of refreshment, in all its beauty and dignity, an occasion for inspiration and fellowship, a time when the noble old traditions of the craft are preserved. 8. What has become of that quote-unquote course of moral instruction veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols that Freemasonry is supposed to be? If it is a course of instruction, then there should be teachers, and if ours is a progressive science, then the teaching of a Master Mason should not end when he is raised. I am not talking about dry professional lectures or sermons. Heavens, no. That is the kind of thing that makes Masonic education an anathema. Where are the parables and allegories? Alas, they have descended into booklets and stunts. No wonder interest is so hard to sustain. 9. Hasn't the so-called century of the common man contributed to making our fraternity a little too common? We cannot expect to retain the prestige the craft has enjoyed in the past if we continue without challenge to permit the standards of the picnic ground, the bowling alley, the private club, and the golf links to be brought into the lodge hall. Whether we like it or not, a general lowering of standards has left its mark on every lodge in Indiana, large and small. 10. Are there not too many well-meaning brethren who are working overtime to make Freemasonry something other than Freemasonry? It was an unhappy day when some eager beaver conceived the idea that our craft should adopt the methods of a service club, or the luncheon group, or the civic league, or the Playboy outfit. Whoever the eager beaver was, he lost sight of the fact that one of the reasons our fraternity is prized so highly is that it does not operate like other organizations. End quote. Dwight L. Smith then finishes with this, quote, "Well, that should be enough for one dose. The following pages elaborate on the 10 points enumerated above. Let me give you fair warning. In the following essays, I shall call a spade a spade. Some of my readers are not going to like it. But what I have to say, I believe our craft needs to hear, and it is only for the good of the order that it is said. I shall propose no bright new ideas, not one. All I am going to advocate is that Freemasonry remain Freemasonry, and if we have strayed from the traditional path, we had better be moving back to the main line while there is yet time to restore the prestige and respect, the interest and loyalty and devotion that once was ours." End quote. It is my goal in the next few articles to highlight these 10 points that Most Worshipful Brother Smith elaborates on and to offer my own perspectives on his words. Like him, I do not intend to pull any punches. You'll either agree or disagree with him, me, or both of us. I don't agree with some of his arguments, as you will see. However, I do believe that his work is a blueprint for ancient craft Freemasonry to follow, which is still applicable today. For those of you who like what I've read so far, you can read the rest of the book at this PDF link. Darren A. Laners. So yeah, this particular piece that he has started here really lays out the foundation of the coming articles. I'll be reading each one each week with his permission, and I think you all will enjoy his perspectives. Darren is one who really rarely pulls any punches and does not or is not afraid to share his opinion on topics that may be difficult to discuss. So I want to thank Brother Darren for his particular interest in going through these, because it is quite the task to do. So of these 10 that we read so far, and if you have to go back and listen, I invite you to do so, or click on the link in the show notes to go back to it. For the Craftsman Plus, I really would love to know what your favorite point of these 10 are. You know, what is the one thing that stands out to you that you've seen the most? For me, and I'll put this in the show notes also, I think number 4 is very interesting. Are we not worshiping at the altar of bigness? You know, we are in this race to amplify the craft in such a way that we get so many new members, and yet the more members we get, the less we know the people in our organization. We're in a race to get bigger, but the relationships that we share with the few brethren that really matter to us suffer. This is, you know, you can look up some of the science on this called Dunbar's number, but certainly I think we can all agree that, I'll quote a funny movie, The Cable Guy, right? When Matthew Broderick looks at Jim Carrey and he tells him, "I just don't have any more room for new friends in my life right now." And that's because, you know, of course, in that movie, the particular context is that he just doesn't like Jim Carrey's character. But what if you got to a point where Freemasonry could eventually become a hindrance to you? We are expected to remember our brothers and friends, and we're supposed to remember the things that make their lives special or the things that they're struggling with. And that just becomes harder and harder the more people that you bring into the fold. But that's just my thought on it. It's kind of the reason why I like the small lodge idea, you know, 27 to 45 members, and when you hit that number, you got to break off and form a new lodge. I think that's smart. But I'd love to hear what your favorite was. All right, Now, next up, let's get into this new segment with worshipful brother Patrick Day, Masonic Mythbusters.
Ah, it's Christmastide. It's that magical time of year in which your neo-pagan and probably atheist friends to come out of the woodwork on social media and say things like, "The Christians stole December 25th from the pagans." I used to be one of those people, so I know how annoying they can be. Let's dig in. Firstly, who are these so-called pagans they speak of? It's a rather nebulous term with no exact specificity. Really, the term pagan comes from the Latin paganus, literally meaning rural or country dweller, rustic, so forth. By the 4th century AD, Christians came to use the term to refer to anyone who was not Christian. That is, they're referring to anyone who's living outside the urban hubs where Christians were largely congregated. Obviously, when these sorts of people say things like, "Christians stole it from the pagans," they mean Roman pagans. And the celebration of December 25th is ultimately a Roman thing. Of course, it's all exceedingly more complex than just Romans and Christians and pagans and who stole what from who. We should understand that Christians were Romans. Christianity is a Roman religion as it emerges in the Roman Empire. Hence the use of later terms like Roman Catholicism and Holy Roman Empire. Early Christians did not see any conflict between their identities as being Christian and Roman. No more than my buddy David feels there's a conflict between being an atheist and an American, or my friend Kitty being Jewish and American, or my neighbor across the street about being Christian and American. These are not mutually exclusive concepts of socio-religious identity. Certainly later, Roman rulers would have a problem with Christians, probably because they were weird and said things like they drink the blood and eat the body of their god, and they may be up to some weird sorcery by raising the dead, or so they say, and they're worshipping some criminal the Romans just executed, like, last week. But Christians, early Christians, largely did not see a conflict with being Christian and Roman, even though later Christians would have a problem with being Roman. They tend to come into conflict, but ultimately through the first 3 centuries of Christianity as a Roman religion, there was no conflict. This is important to bear in mind, because when early Christianity is developing its sense of cultural identity, it's coming out of their indoctrination as Romans in a Roman society. It is not like there are some Christians roaming around looking for some small isolated pagan tribe to steal ideas from. They grew up in a Roman culture, religion, and politics. Many of the big movers and shakers in early Christianity were, in fact, Roman citizens. Paul, Augustine, etc. Further, being Roman meant a lot of things, as the Roman Empire was quite vast, and the emperors were not entirely concerned with micromanaging the religions and cultures across their empire. Thus, many regions were permitted to keep their old ways as long as they acknowledged the Roman emperor was their chief civic ruler. Hence why Herod was permitted to be king of Israel, while the Pharisees were permitted to continue to run the Temple of Jehovah, while Pontius Pilate is stationed as the governor and the one who answers directly to the emperor. Augustine was North African, origin was Greco-Egyptian living in Alexandria, Paul was from Tarsus of modern-day Turkey, etc. These Christians, they're all Romans. Even Jesus was a provincial citizen of the Roman Empire, whereas Paul is a civis Romani, a full Roman citizen. Now, a provincial citizen was basically legally recognized as being under Roman rule and had some basic human rights, i.e., they're not subject to slavery unless they truly are classified as a slave. So when that annoying atheist friend of yours likes to say things like Jesus was an immigrant, this completely ignores all the nuances of Roman citizenship and the privileges therefrom. But back to the main subject. Did the Christians really steal December 25th? Kinda, but not really. Sometimes you will hear these people say that the Christians stole Saturnalia, other times they stole December 25th, and so other times that they stole the solstice. So let's dig in, because none of these are the same thing. Saturnalia was a week-long festival starting from the Ides of December, that is mid-December, and lasting until December 23rd. And it was done in honor of the god Saturn, and was more like an inversion ritual than anything else, where customs and norms are sort of overturned. Now, the winter solstice on the Julian calendar would have fallen somewhere between the 20th and the 22nd, but the Romans, for whatever reason, did not observe the solstice on the solstice, but on December 25th, because the Romans were weird. Then again, I mean, we as Americans, we celebrate July 4th as the day of the Declaration of Independence being officiated, even though it was not actually signed until August 12th. Oh well, calendar's kind of arbitrary anyway. Now, back to December 25th. It is another matter of significance. This is because December 25th, 274 Anno Domini, Roman Emperor Aurelius establishes the cult of Sol Invictus, who is a Romanization of Assyrian sun god, Elagabalus, whom Emperor Elagabalus tried to popularize, with no success, half a century before, and from whence he actually gets his name. Now, Aurelius establishes a temple to Sol Invictus, and it was dedicated on the date, December 25th, 274, and it was decided that every 4 years there would be games in honor of the unconquered sun. Important to note, the Roman calendar starts with the spring equinox, which, according to the Romans, is March 25th, which is a few days after the actual spring equinox. Now, what is 9 months after March 25th? December 25th. That's the gestation period of a human child. This is perfect. This is why March 25th is the feast day of the Annunciation of the Virgin Mary. The 3rd and 4th century Christians were obsessed with trying to date the life of Jesus based on the scant contextual clues from the Gospels. These chronographers had a particular fascination with people being born and dying on the same day, or being conceived and dying on the same day. Prophet Muhammad is believed to have been born and died on the 12th day of Rabi al-Awwal. It is not a totally unusual concept. But since the Islamic calendar is a lunar one, the Julian date changes every year, so no one could accuse the Muslims of stealing a date from the pagans, except, I guess, in 2015 when the 12th day of Rabi al-Awwal fell on December 25th. Thus, it was believed that Jesus was conceived and died on March 25th and born on December 25th. Now, such chronographic speculations can be found in Tertullian, Hippolytus, Augustine, etc. Now, some of your noxious friends with a Christian antagonistic disposition will say things like, Jesus was born in April, or Jesus was born in December, or whatever. Of course, these are just as arbitrary as December 25th, because we have to face the fact that no one knows exactly when Jesus was born. Period. Anyone saying that Jesus was born in any other time than December 25th is pulling it out of their rear, because there simply is no evidence whatsoever of when he possibly could have been born. So it might as well be a day of significance to a new Roman religion. It is almost as if, because they don't like Christians and Christianity, they tend to make stuff up. It's okay to not like Christians. I'm a Christian and I don't even like Christians. It's like enjoying a musical band with an incredibly annoying fan base. Furthermore, people will say, Mithras was born on December 25th. No. No, he was not. It's clear they watched Bill Maher's Religulous and they never looked any further. Mithras is another sun god that was Romanized, but from Persia. Like Elagabalus, Mithras is a foreign god that the Romans pretty much adopt in name only, as he bears little resemblance to his foreign origins. Thus, Mithras is Persian in name only, and really is a Roman god. He is not born on December 25th, and we know that because the date of Mithras' birth is not important. Have you ever wondered when Hiram Abiff was born? That's right, you don't wonder that, because that's not what's important about Hiram Abiff. He could have also been born on December 25th, but that's not what matters. Mithras' birthday is just not a part of any Mithraic myth cycle. At least not until 1274, when Aurelius forms the cult of Sol Invictus. Mithraic cults latch onto the idea as much as early Christians. Suddenly emerges that an important date associated with an unconquered solar god, and multiple people and cults latch onto it. Does this mean that the Mithraic cults stole December 25th from the pagans? No, that's absurd. They're adopting an official concept and celebration within their own culture. The early Christians were doing the same thing. So did the Christians steal December 25th from the pagans? Well, with a very loose definition of stealing and pagan, the answer would be kind of, but not really. They weren't stealing Saturnalia, because that would mean a week-long celebration of Saturn was stolen by a Roman emperor to celebrate the sun for one day, but with all tomfoolery. They weren't stealing the solstice, because December 25th was not the actual solstice, and even the Romans knew that. And they weren't exactly stealing December 25th from the Romans, because early Christians were Romans. They were adopting an idea that other religious cults were adopting as well, and doing so within the very culture they were living and participating within. It's just a weird idea to say that it's stealing when it's within your own culture. It's like I'm stealing some milk from the fridge in my own house. Everyone in my family partakes of this milk, but when I drink it, it's stealing. So ultimately, no. The Christians didn't steal December 25th from the pagans, because there are no pagans. They weren't stealing it from the Romans, because they were Romans. It's just a holiday. But nonetheless, Merry Christmas.
Well, there you have this awesome new segment by Brother Patrick Day, Passmaster. And he's involved in a lot of great research out there. You can find a lot of his work that's been published in Philalethes magazine. It's been published in the Rocky Mountain Mason and various other places. And I'm just so excited that he decided to take this little journey with us to be able to talk about some things that we constantly see a barrage of misinformation being posted online. Whether those are deprecating to certain religions or Masonic myths, what have you. But I think, Brother Patrick Day, to start this one off, you know, this one was actually supposed to be released prior, but we just didn't get around to it. And so I hope you guys enjoyed this little Christmas edition, even though it's a couple weeks past. You know, it still is relevant, and now we all know a little bit better, historically, the truth about whether or not pagans, quote-unquote, stole Christmas or whatever. But as Brother Patrick Day has pointed out, the case for that is a little thin. Not to say anything against paganism, neo-paganism, Christianity, or any other religion. It's just in the idea that one stole something from the other, in the historical and contextual sense. I think Brother Patrick Day has more than given us enough information to be dangerous in that argument for the future. You can look for more segments coming up over the coming weeks, and I have an open invitation for Patrick to record these and get them to us indefinitely. So as long as he's willing to do it, we will accept them and put them in the podcast. And I hope you guys really enjoy the new segment, new year, new segments. And don't worry, nothing's going away. Illustrious Brother Harrison will still be providing us with Masonic Minutes, as far as I know. So our thanks goes out to Illustrious Brother Harrison as well for his continued work in creating content for this show. A couple of you have reached out to ask me, you know, where can I find Steve Harrison's YouTube channel? Well, aside from finding his videos on our YouTube channel, you can find him on his YouTube channel, and it's not just, you know, the Masonic Minute. You look up the 1 Minute Mason. That's what you can look up, and you'll find him. You'll see a cool picture of Steve there. Something else that has been relaunched. You may or may not have heard, Masonic Curators is back. That's right. Head on over to curators.wcypodcast.com. It'll shoot you right over to the YouTube channel where we're uploading those videos. We did 51 or 52 videos, mostly of myself, a few guests, and recently the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts and my close friends and brothers, Brother Brian Simmons and Brother Michael Jarzebeck, Right Worshipful Brothers, actually, from the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, where I am also a member, have decided to take up the charge of creating new content for that channel. Now, the exciting part is that these are professionally done videos. These artifacts will just blow your mind. And you'll look for new episodes coming out every Monday, I believe. We've got them scheduled to come out, likely to come out in perhaps seasons and waves. But I hope you like it, and there's a lot of great content coming there. So if you would like, head on over to Masonic Curators and click on the subscribe button, and you'll be getting brand new videos. The channel has been growing and growing, even though I've not been producing content for it, but now it has new life. And in fact, there may be even more new life coming to that channel real soon, as I partner up with, perhaps, an appendant body for a large-scale historical project. Now, before we get into the tarot portion of this week, it was something that I think struck a lot of people, and it was just crazy to wake up to the news. We saw posts from all these Masonic titans about the passing of Right Worshipful Brother Thomas W. Jackson. And, you know, we're going to publish what I'm about to read. Not only was it published on the Midnight Freemasons, and I'm reading it here, we're also going to put it in the Lyceum for the January issue, which will be coming out probably between the 15th and 20th, and is available to anybody who would like to check it out. If you're on the Grand Lodge, Illinois, email, distribution list, you'll get it if you're a Master Mason. If you're not under the jurisdiction of Illinois, then you'll get it by heading on over to the Illinois Lodge of Research and just clicking on the Grand Lodge Illinois Education page, where we also host back issues. So without further ado, let's pay some respects here. If you don't know, you'll quickly become acquainted here. So, The Passing of Right Worshipful Brother Thomas W. Jackson by Senior Midnight Freemason Contributor Gregory J. Knott. On December 30th, 2021, Masonic Social Media announced the passing of Right Worshipful Brother Thomas W. Jackson. What quickly followed was a large number of tributes and memories that brothers had reflected upon the life and impact of Right Worshipful Brother Jackson. If you are not familiar with Right Worshipful Brother Jackson, he was the past Grand Secretary of the Right Worshipful Grand Lodge Free and Accepted Masons of Pennsylvania. He had also served as the first executive secretary of the World Conference of Regular Masonic Grand Lodges from 1998 to 2014. He held numerous Masonic honors from around the world, including as one of the founding fellows of the Masonic Society. I met Right Worshipful Brother Jackson a couple of times at Masonic Week when his book, Masonic Perspectives, The Thoughts of a Grand Secretary, was published. He was selling it at a table at Masonic Week. I bought the book and asked him to autograph it for me. As I was flipping through the book, I noticed that he had written a couple articles on the topic of scouting. We had a conversation about the similarities between scouting and Freemasonry. Brother Jackson, like myself, is an Eagle Scout and had been involved in scouting as both youth and adult leaders. It was a fascinating conversation. In his book, he wrote about speaking at an Eagle Court of Honor offering some thoughts on the influence and said, quote, "We cannot take a step in our lives without the influence of others. We will be nothing more at any time than a reflection of the influence of others along with our modifications." The poet Markham expressed it well when he wrote, quote, "There is a destiny that makes us brothers. None goes his way alone. All that we send into the lives of others comes back into our own," end quote. So, my brother Eagles, will you go beyond the ordinary? Is it possible? It is possible, but it is up to you. Accept what scouting has to offer. Learn. Learn the meaning of the brotherhood of man and give it to others in equal measure what others have given to you. Maybe then, just maybe, you may rise above the ordinary. End quote. Though Brother Jackson was speaking to young Eagle Scouts, his words are equally applicable to Freemasonry. We are influenced by others, and thereby we also influence others ourselves. As Freemasons, we have a tremendous opportunity to use this ability to influence others, to help improve our individual communities, having a positive impact upon the lives of others. What will the legacy of Right Worshipful Brother Jackson be? His challenge to raise the bar of Freemasonry will endure for the decades to come. I can't think of a better way to honor the memory of Right Worshipful Brother Jackson than by going out to your community, having a positive influence on others, exerting kindness to your brothers, and helping your lodge become the very best it can be to impact all of mankind. Rest in peace, brother. Greg J. Knott. So some very beautiful words there by Brother Greg Knott about the beautiful soul Thomas W. Jackson, who has graduated to the great and next place. Congratulations to Brother Jackson for a life well lived, and cheers as you go to the next place. All right. As we move along this week, the last thing we're going to do here, if you have been following at all in the last few months, maybe weeks, is that we've been taking a look at the tarot. Not as something to be divinatory or cartomancy or tell the future or palm reading or whatever, but rather to look at the prescribed meaning of a card and then think about possibly what that could be or mean for us in a Masonic context. Now, the tarot is not inherently Masonic, but the symbolism represented on the cards definitely is. And a lot of the concepts that are conveyed within the tarot are also conveyed in Freemasonry. So, what I'll do is I'll just grab a deck, as I've been doing. We'll pull one card, talk about the prescribed meaning, and then maybe what it could mean in the practical sense for our minds to use today. So, this week, I'm pulling out... The last few weeks, we've actually had a couple different decks we've been using. This week, I'm going to go back to a standard Smith-Waite deck, 78 cards, consisting of both major and minor arcana. There are no changes, no alternate versions. I'm just going to split the deck in two and then shuffle each side and put them back together. Sometimes people will ask, and I say this every week, is there some number of times that you shuffle the cards? The answer is no. Sometimes people say, oh, you know, you shouldn't buy your own tarot decks. They have to be gifted. I don't buy that either. It depends on how, quote-unquote, woo-woo you want to be. Do you put your cards and do you put them in the most eastern part of your house to receive the rising sun rays? Maybe. Whatever you want to do. You know, it's symbolic to you. That's who it matters to. It's not like you can do it wrong for you, right? Because it's just for your perspective. So don't sit out there and let some tarot, quote-unquote, expert, you know, tell you that you're doing it so wrong. You know, these are cards for your own individual perspectives, and nobody can tell you different. There's a reason why when somebody goes to a tarot reading, they think, oh my gosh, the tarot reading was so perfect. And it's always going to be perfect because the cards are reflective of your life situations. It's not like people are telling your future, right? You're always going to find a meaning in the card when they present you with the idea that the card has, because it is an objective kind of idea. And then you project the subjective narrative on top of it. What am I talking about? Well, let's find out. Let's just draw a random card from this Smith-Waite deck. Oh, and really quick, I said Smith-Waite, and people are like, what's that? That's just the Rider-Waite deck, commonly known. But I call it Smith-Waite because Pamela Coleman Smith is the artist who did all the artwork, so it's only right to include her name in it, just out of a respect. So I hope you all do that too. Smith-Waite deck. Here we go, we're going to flip one card. Okay, I drew key number 4, which is the Emperor. The Emperor card is a kind of a striking card. It's just one dude who's sitting on a throne. The Smith-Waite deck has the throne that has, you know, arm handles that are like ram's heads and a lot of really awesome symbology. We drew the card inversed. So if the card had been upright, the Emperor is emitting a feeling of authority. He is the pillar of establishment, representing a structure or even a father figure for some. And if it's reversed, it may mean that we're dealing with feelings of domination, excessive control, or having a lack of discipline either on our part or somebody we know. Or it could mean that we're being inflexible or that somebody we know is exhibiting signs of inflexibility in their own life. Whether this is work-related or in your fraternity, certainly we know somebody in our lives that might fit this description. And people would say, well, who are we to judge based on those? And the idea here is that we're not judging those people or even ourselves. We're thinking about why we think about those people as these things, and then really how we can assist. So if we look at the Empress card, that's the mother archetype of the tarot deck. The Emperor is the masculine or father-like architect of the card. Again, he sits on this stone throne, ram's head on either side, which has a connection with the planet Mars. Why? Because Mars deals with Aries, the ram. And in his right hand, he holds a ankh, or a scepter, the Egyptian symbol of life. And then he holds the orb in his other hand. Now, this same orb can be found on your playing cards. If you find the king, he'll be holding this little ball that's got a cross on it, which is an amalgamation of the emperor card itself, having the ball, the orb, with the ankh on it as a cross. And so the orb represents the world over which he rules. So this is manifesting control over the world and holding life in the other hand. So you've got the world, you've got control, and the life. The colors on the card, too, are indicative of power. Being red, he's got armor, it suggests that he has protection from any threats. And those threats aren't like bullets, right? This is threats of emotional response or vulnerability. And the long beard is indicative of wisdom and all of these things. So, because we drew the emperor reversed, this is asking us to really think about our relationships with how much power we have, how much control, responsibility, and discipline and control. Are we pushing too much discipline, control, authority onto our employees, our kids, our spouses, significant others, our families? Maybe too little. And by doing so, is this working for us or against us? I've heard from many people that when they draw this card, it might suggest that an authority figure that you regularly deal with is abusing their power. Now, some positive aspects of this card, it's not all gloom and doom. Like, this just helps us call to the idea that maybe this reflective idea of are we exerting too much or not enough, this is, you know, very similar to the four cardinal virtues. Maybe some prudence and fortitude in there mixed around. A couple other meanings for this card, though, might mean that, in the reversed sense, others might be looking to you as their leader, or their SME, or subject matter expert, in a particular area of business or trade that you're involved in. However, you might be shying away from the role. So, in this instance, it's telling you to recognize your own authority and to take charge of the situation, to become that emperor. It also might be telling you to stand up to authority, within reason. Don't let people walk all over you. In a respectful way, you need to right those kinds of circumstances. So with this card, really pay attention to your commitments, your goals, your discipline. And then, of course, people are always asking about relationships in tarot. And I don't usually like to talk about relationships in tarot, but it is a number one question people always ask about. So if this comes up with a relationship type reading of a tarot, maybe this means that you're unhappy because you feel like you give more than the partner does. Or maybe there's some overbearingness or possessiveness going on. Again, going back to that dominating and authoritative mindset, whether it's from you or the other person. But that's it for this week. I want to thank all of you for joining me this week and this edifying journey. I will post a picture of the tarot card for all of you in the Craftsman Plus group. Your question for this week on this card is, when we think about if we are over-domineering or under-domineering, if we are a little too hard on people or a little too lenient, where do you think you stand? Are you just in the middle? Are you perfectly balanced? I'll be curious to hear what you have to say, and perhaps, if you feel comfortable, sharing a story. I know I will attempt to share a little something in there as well. My thanks again goes out to our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. We cannot do the show without you. You guys make it all possible. We're in the plans of putting together the legacy partner episode here in the next couple weeks. I know I've been saying it for a while, but it's been taking a little bit to secure this particular guest that we're going to get. I'm really excited about it. I want to also invite you guys one more time to check out Masonic Curators by going to curators.wcypodcast.com. Click like and subscribe to all their videos on WCY, on Masonic Curators. And, the fourth Thursday in February, we're going to have illustrious brother, Stephen L. Harrison on the Masonic Roundtable. And we're going to talk a little bit about generational Freemasonry. Again, part two, if you will. I think we're going to have a lot to say. It's going to be a charged up, awesome episode. I'm really excited about it. You know, we're going to all be on the level and talk about things as we hear a little bit from the perspective of the highly respected Stephen L. Harrison. Before we close out, I do want to just give a quick shout out to Brother Matthew Gallagher one more time. He did a couple segments for us on practical Freemasonry. His book is out now. It is fantastic. I think you really will enjoy it. Another book that is out right now that you can pick up is from your favorite Masonic fiction writer since Carl Claudy. That's going to be Brother Bill Hosler, who put out his book, Meditations on a Flawed Ashler. You can pick them up at uponthesquare.com or .org. I'll put a link to everything we talked about in the show notes. And with that, we'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition. Thank you.